Welcome to the Owning Your Menopause podcast with me, Kate Roham, menopause fitness coach, author of the best-selling book, Owning Your Menopause, Fitter, Calmer, Stronger in 30 Days, and founder of the Owning Your Menopause app. Navigating this life stage can seem daunting and almost impossible for many women, but I want to help you reframe how you see this chapter. In each episode, my guests will share one thing you might be able to implement so you can start thriving through menopause and beyond. This podcast will help you see that you aren't alone and there is always hope and support. The Owning Your Menopause podcast is sponsored by Ancient and Brave. Ancient and Brave offers an award-winning range of collagen, MCT oil, and nootropic blends. Whether you're seeking mental focus, stress resilience, more energy, or joint support, their pure, potent, and easy-to-use supplements will help you achieve your health goals naturally. I start my day with Ancient and Brave collagen and coffee and finish with their nightcap blend, and I highly recommend you try it. I am super excited for my guest today and credit her for much of my understanding and knowledge. So here with me all the way from New Zealand is Dr. Stacey Sims. Stacey is a forward-thinking international exercise physiologist and nutrition scientist who has revolutionized exercise, nutrition, and performance for women. She has directed research programs focusing on female athlete health and performance and pushing the dogma to improve research on all women. Sims advises that for training to prevent injury and illness, it's important to have women-tailored training programs that balance volume with intensity, plus one-legged exercises for control, stability, and overall running technique. She says for our women to remain uninjured and keep progressing, we need to rethink about the volume. We need some time on the feet, but we don't need to do the significant amount of volume that's ingrained in all of the running programs because all of those are based on male data. Raw was the first book I read on exercise and women and what changes we need to make as we head into midlife and menopause, with a huge emphasis on lifting weights. I am an absolute fan and I am so excited to share this conversation with you. Stacey, thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, thanks. I'm like, whoa, have I done all that? Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, you have, and more. You've got your other book as well, Next Level, which I know focuses a little bit more on perimenopause and menopause. But as I said kind of before we came on, like, you have literally opened my eyes to how we need to train through this life stage. And it's been fundamental in learning myself how to thrive and what I obviously share with women in my community. I feel that you were well ahead of the game when it came to the realization that women are not small men, which I love, and we need to train differently. Can you expand on this for listeners? And like, what was your, I guess, like your defining moment of realizing that pounding the pavements, cardio for like an hour was no longer serving us?
Yeah, I think it was accumulation of a few things. I mean, I ended up doing my master's degree on overtraining in female runners across the menstrual cycle, and was seeing significant differences across the menstrual cycle, but also differences with regards to mood and immunity that we saw in the literature on men. So being a young research scientist, turning to my supervisor, I'm like, I'm sure I didn't do anything wrong here. And he's like, nope, we've done everything, stepped away. It's a sex difference. So that was kind of like the first thing where I was like, okay, well, I increased their volume by 25% to purposely overtrain them. And these are the responses that we see with immune system taking a hit, severe fatigue, lack of vigor. We're starting to see some menstrual cycle dysfunction. But the literature showed in men that when you increase the volume that much, you didn't get any of these perturbations. They actually got increase in vigor, they got more aggressive, they got faster, so they could withstand the volume. And that was kind of one of the first seeds that got planted in my head, that something was different here. And this also comes on the back of the experiences I had as a rower in undergrad, where the women's boat was training how the men were, and yet we weren't peaking at the same time. And it was the early stages of really reading and I know that my infamous story about my results being thrown out in some of the metabolism labs. So it was just these little step by steps where I was like, wait, there's something here, something here. Then we fast forward, did my PhD, saw, you know, differences across the menstrual cycle or a contraceptive pill compared to men. There are differences there. But then when I got to Stanford and was doing a deep dive into the Women's Health Initiative, and at the same time, I was racing. I was on the pro bike race scene, and I was racing, and I was working with people who are working with the men. And so we have this whole like shift of here are some peri and postmenopausal women. They're experiencing all these signs and symptoms, and here are all these elite athletes. And yet the application of exercise to both groups was based on data that was from men, because we were trying to see, okay, what do we do for the Women's Health Initiative when we wanted to start this new exercise study? And then I'm seeing what we're doing as women in the Peloton training versus what the men are doing. And we're doing the same things. Like, no, this isn't right. So you start reading into the physiology and start doing trials and conversation. And you realize the basis of it all is strength training. You have to have that strong foundation in order to attenuate so many of these pelvic burden diseases that we see in the older population. But also in that elite athlete population, a lot of the men in the Peloton had really poor bone density because they weren't lifting and they weren't doing any kind of strength training to offset all the time on the bike. So when we start looking at the two extremes and coming back down, like what's the basis to really enhance overall health and longevity? It's being strong. It's having cognitive support. And it's not spending hours and hours in that cardiovascular state where you're increasing cortisol, you're increasing that catabolism, losing lean mass, losing bone, getting endocrine dysfunction. So yeah, it was a lot of learning processes along the way that then started this journey that I'm still sharing and doing at the present time.
Yeah, you know, that's so interesting because I think kind of picking up on a few things you've said there, certainly this cohort of women that, you know, obviously the conversation with menopause is very much at the forefront, but this cohort of women that I think are now really experiencing the perimenopause symptoms and they're in the thick of it, they've come from a society that's been ingrained, as I sort of said in that introduction, where we have to pound the pavement. As soon as you start to put on weight, let's up the exercise, let's start decreasing calories, let's start skipping. And then we'll come onto that later. All these new fads, diets, fasting, keto, like we're just fed like all this misinformation. And it's really hard breaking that narrative. And when I sort of say to people, you know, taper back on HIIT, that like sheer panic that they're going to put on weight sets in. Like, talk me through that, because it's, I feel like that's the wall that so many women need to climb over to reach peak performance at this life stage.
Yes. I mean, most of us grew up in that 80s and 90s era of snack wells and low fat, high carb and calories in, calories out. You have to do 70 to 90 minutes of aerobics to keep your weight down and to burn fat and get in that fat burning zone. And it's a huge disservice, but society put us in that mindset. And it was part of the empowerment of women because that was coming on the tail end of women getting involved in marathons and seeing that and more games more sports in the Olympics that were taking women in. So this empowerment of women in sport also came with this idea that in order to be successful, we had to be small. We had to be taking up less room, and we also couldn't be fallible with regards to we have a period or, you know, we have any kind of injury. So we are all taught that we have to do all of this exercise to maintain a certain size, and we can't talk about how it makes us not feel so great. So, I mean, you think about the supermodels of the 90s, the, you know, Kate Moss and all the women there who had this particular look where there's no muscle, super thin, or on the verge of being overly too thin. And those are the images that we had all the time and had to refer back to. So now as we're getting older and we're in our late 40s, early 50s, and we have now this conversation that that's not right. It's a huge societal and ingrained mind shift that we have to overcome, because everyone is so afraid that one, if they eat carbohydrates, or two, if they drop the volume of their training, they're going to put on weight. Unfortunately, when women first start to do that, they do put on weight, but it's not tissue weight. It's now they're having more glycogen in their muscle. And with glycogen, that comes water. They're having an expansion in their plasma volume, which is also water. So we can basically say it's water weight. But when they start looking at at polarizing their training and they start doing resistance training, then we have a decrease in inflammation. We have a decrease in the signaling to put on visceral fat. We have less of a load on the liver, which means that we can, quote, detox our body more. And so all of these things feed forward to then better body composition, which means that, yes, weight on the scale might be up because muscle and bone weigh more than fat, but body composition and the way aesthetically that you look is completely different. It's trying to get women over that 3 week to 6 week hump of changing where, yes, they're going to be very uncomfortable with what's happening, but it's the long game and trusting the process.
Yeah. And I think that that, again, is absolutely like nail on the head. We are such a society of quick fix, you know, and we want to commit and we then want it to happen tomorrow. And, you know, you see this, which I'm sure you do as well, doing what you do, this cyclical pattern of someone like, yes, I'm going to do this. And then literally within 2 weeks, they've set themselves such a high bar that they can't sustain it because they've just set such an unrealistic goal. They drop off. And then it just becomes this like constant, you know, thing where I think both of us are trying to say like 365 days of the year, your body needs to be looked after and it's not going to happen overnight. And you need to commit for kind of like, I even go like 3 months, 6 months, give them the worst case scenario. And then I think on that, you've touched on so many things and we'll come to that, is also not to look at what is happening, but to feel what is happening. Are you sleeping better? Are your moods better? You know, have you got less anxiety? Because obviously those are all the symptoms that are thrown up in perimenopause. And then the excuses that do, I think, come again with a lot of the women are fatigued. And let's maybe touch on that because I think that that is important. We've talked about obviously adrenal fatigue, the cortisol, and that comes obviously by not eating because your body becomes stressed, low estrogen, your body is stressed, and then you are tired. And I realize for a lot of women that that is a huge obstacle. I often say, and I would love your perspective as someone who is so much more advanced in this space, I just say to women, just try and move your body every day, regardless of kind of what might have happened the night before.
Absolutely. And we want women to have a plan, but if there's movement within the plan, that if they had a really bad sleep the night before and it's a hard and fast plan, they wake up and go, oh, I have to do a sprint interval training session. And most women are dedicated to a plan and will try to do it, but they don't get benefit because they only hit moderate intensity. It makes them more tired and it perpetuates that whole cycle. So having that ability to say, you know, I had a really bad sleep and I just don't have the energy. My brain isn't working today. I'm just going to do something a little bit less intense. Maybe I'm just going to go for a walk in the sun to help me. And that's fine. I'm finding that women are looking for permission to do that. I can't tell you how many women I've talked to in the past about 6 or 8 weeks that it's okay if you had a really bad night and you can't do that workout today. It's okay to move it. It's not a hard set plan. So it's part of that permission aspect as well that we have to give too.
I think that that is the hardest thing. Like women have been dictated to that we can have it all. And I think there comes a point where it's like, you know, we can't have it all because something is gonna give. I'm going to move on because you talk so passionately. I know we've touched on this briefly about lifting weights, you know, lifting heavy shit. And I love it because whenever I do a post about lifting heavy, women are like, what is heavy? And, you know, when you then come out with kind of, you know, the progressive overload and you talk them through and you're like, this is how we need to make change. People really panic because there is this myth to dispel that obviously they're going to bulk up. I think we criticize ourselves. We don't believe that we can lift heavy shit. And we don't know what that looks like because no one's really guided this current cohort going through. So I often talk about it, but I talk about it again from a very simplified level because I'm not a doctor of sports science. Can you just, I guess, really hone in why women still have this adverse opinion of weights and like really why it is so important that women start lifting literally as soon as they listen to this conversation?
Yeah. Everyone go out and get a barbell for their house. I love it. The history of learning all this stuff. So I was digging into the history of strength training, and initially strength training for women started with the strong woman competition. So you start to see these images from the 1800s of women who were part of the circus, lifting their husbands up, you know, and so that was the image we had of strong women. So as we bring it into society, and the, I guess, the boxes that women were put in, they weren't supposed to be strong. They weren't supposed to be able to be better than their husband or lift their husband up. They were supposed to be put in this box and be supportive. So as we start breaking through into sport, it was okay to be running because we saw that. It was okay to be riding, playing tennis, all of these kind of more cardio sports, but no one pushed the strength training until around 2000 or so when CrossFit started. And then all of a sudden it was okay to see women lifting heavy, but they were still put in this box of they're elite athletes doing things I can't do. So it's this whole societal idea that we aren't supposed to be lifting. If there was a friend of mine who put a post up yesterday, he was looking in Shutterstock for women who lifted heavy weights, and all he could find were thin white women with those little pink dumbbells who he, you know, he's looking for women 40 plus. And those are the only images he could find. And so we're all like, take pictures of us, you know, we're the real women who are lifting weights. So there's that perpetual societal idea that we're not supposed to be lifting weights. And it's also perpetuated by a gym. If you go into a gym and you're a woman and you do the intake form, they go, well, this is a list of the HIIT classes and the spin classes, and there's the cardio, and there are the dumbbells. If you're a guy and you go in, they're like, oh, how much weight do you want to gain, muscle mass you want to gain? Here's the lifting platforms, you know, here are the bumper plates. And so it's very, very gendered when you go into a gym. So it's still perpetuating that myth that women aren't supposed to lift. But physicality, we should be and can be. And we have less fatigability. So that means we can go in and we can do five sets of five with less recovery between to get better adaptations. So when we're trying to really push women into resistance training, trying to break that mold of we're not talking about 20 bodyweight squats. We're not talking about the pink dumbbells. We're talking about learning how to move functionally so that you can do compound movement. So if you have to squat down and pick up a heavy thing of groceries, you can because you have the technique and you have the strength for it. So when you start putting the functionality into it, women suddenly go, oh, I get it. I get it. I don't have to be that afraid, but how do I start? So that's where, this is where that conversation is. It's like, I don't want anyone to go buy that barbell for their house and put on 225-kilo plates and start deadlifting if you never have before. I want you to learn how to move properly, and that might take 3 months before you can actually put load on. But it is very valuable, not only for, you know, all of the things we're talking about with alleviating menopausal symptoms, but for brain health. Because when we see, not only do we have all the physicality of lifting where it changes body composition, it helps with muscle speed and power, it helps with bone density, but the biggest thing is it creates new neural pathways in the brain, which definitively slows cognitive decline and helps reduce the risk factors for things like dementia and Alzheimer's. So when we talk about what kind of lifting we should be doing and why, we go back to what does estrogen do for women? So we talk about estradiol, that is our testosterone. It's responsible for our muscle cells actually growing and responding to nutrition and strength training, so protein and strength training. It's responsible for how tight our muscle fibers are actually contracting together and bonding together, and how fast the nerve is able to innervate those fibers for contraction. So when we start losing estrogen, we have to look at an external stress, which is heavy lifting, because now it's causing a central nervous system response. And that central nervous system is now saying we need to recruit more fibers really quickly and have more muscle fibers in order to lift this load. But you don't get that with the higher reps and lower weight. We have to have that central nervous system response, which requires those heavy loads.
Yeah, I love that. And that's, you know, that is the one thing that we really need to encourage women to do, because I do think that still, sadly, I don't know what it's like over there, but over here, we are still sort of the low weights, high reps, you know, kind of like jumping around. And it's kind of, I've actually really been focusing on my classes this last week of like, we're finishing our third round. We've done our sets, like asking people to carry on lifting the weights. If you've gone to 6 or 8 reps more and you're on your last set, you have not gone heavy enough. You want to be feeling like you are pushing through mud. Now, I have got so much to talk about. I'm going to quickly pick up on that as well, because I think it's really important for women. And two of the stats that I like to kind of throw out there, because I think then some women think it's too late. So to start, because obviously our bone density peaks at 30, our muscle mass can begin to decline at around about the age of 35. So I think what's important is that women understand what you've just said, is it will possibly take a little bit longer because we may not have age on our side, but it is by no means impossible.
Exactly. There's been some studies that have been published recently, like within the past 6 months in JAMA and some other like more public health oriented, where they're looking at women who are 70 years and older and having randomized controlled trials where some are doing the lower weight, higher rep, and some are doing more of the power base based on 80% of one rep max. And the women that are doing the lower weight, higher rep, they do put on a little bit of mass, but not a lot. Their strength kind of improves, but the women that are doing the more 80% or more, like the true power training, they build bone, they build lean mass, and they are so much stronger and have more proprioception and balance. And it's because of the tax on the central nervous system that they're finding all these improvements in women who are 70 years old or plus. So it's super important to keep that as part of a longevity strategy.
Yeah. And to encourage parents as well to start lifting if it's something they haven't done. Now, we've talked about lifting, we've talked about the weights, and I really want to come on to these next two things with you. Obviously, diets, fatty diets, fasting. I know there's lots of thoughts about that. I'm going to ask you very quickly, let's just go with protein first, because obviously that is an absolute non-negotiable when it comes to lifting weights. And I think the problem is that women are fasting and then they're not refueling. And that can have obviously a really negative effect. And it's also not allowing muscle recovery and repair to build lean muscle. So maybe we can try and tie those two things in. But I mean, love the protein. Let's go with that.
So when we look at protein, as we age, doesn't matter for a man or a woman, we become more anabolically resistant to protein. So that means that we take protein in and it doesn't stimulate our muscles to build like it should. So we need resistance training, of course, and we need higher protein doses in order to get the response that we want to build that muscle. Again, because we don't have estradiol, we need the building blocks there of resistance training and protein afterwards to really maximize that signaling. The other thing that women are afraid of is putting on body fat. But we see that with a higher doses of protein, we're able to build and maintain lean mass and reduce body fat. So when we're talking about what is one of the most important nutrients that we can have at this point, it's protein. And we look at doses of around 1.8 to 2.2 grams per kilogram per day. And people are like, whoa, that's so much. So you're thinking 120 to 160 grams on average. But it doesn't all have to be from animal. It can be from a whole bunch of different sources. And you end up putting nuts, seeds, grains, edamame, dairy, all sorts of things together, and all of a sudden you're up there, and it's just because you've been conscious of what you're putting in your meals. And we look at it as something that hasn't really been talked about, because all we hear about is fat and carbohydrate so much, and that's been the voice across the whole nutrition space, is too much carb, not enough fat, too much fat, but people haven't talked about protein. And protein is really important for so many different things. And then when we're talking about things like fasted training or coming in fasted and holding a, you know, an overnight fast till noon, and then ended up training in that fasted window, I often ask women why they're training. Because the first thing to go when you start exercising in a fasted state is lean mass. Because it's a very energy hungry tissue. And so your body's going to break it down to help provide the body with the energy it needs. So it's kind of like don't show up to the gym if you haven't had anything to eat, because one, it's going to signal your body to store more fat. It's going to increase the amount of cortisol that has to be released in order to fuel. It keeps you in a sympathetic driven state, and it keeps you in this breakdown state, so you really can't build lean mass. And when we look at population research of holding a fast until noon and having the eating window from like noon to eight, we have poorer sleep, we have a disruption in our circadian rhythm, we have a disruption in our hormone pulses that are related to our circadian rhythm, we don't have better metabolic control. But if you break that fast by eight and then you stop eating after, you know, like six or seven, you're following your circadian rhythm and it's less stress on the body. And we find that body composition improves, metabolic control improves, and sleep improves. So when we talk about the timing of food, it's really important to work with your circadian rhythm so that you're fueling your body appropriately, not only for exercise, but also for daily life stress. And looking at how you are fueling so that you can also have a window of time before you go to bed where your body's not digesting. Normal eating.
Yeah, I know. But the problem is it's been taken away from us. And it terrifies me when we see all that kind of, I mean, you know, is it misinformation? Yeah, it is. And it's people trying to sell like fatty diets. I would love your opinion actually on this, because this is one of the things that I try and encourage women to do, which is to have the three wholesome, balanced, fiber-rich protein meals a day with roughly a 4-hour window in between each, you know, because I think what we see, and I guess it's the same, is when women are fasting, is the snack. I think the snack tendency just tends to kick in because they're so hungry by midday. Their body's like, yes. And then it's, you just want to eat the nuts. And then I find like, I ate like that for so many years. I just found myself picking, like continually picking. There was no rest window for the amount of time I was eating. And I would go to bed just like full and just uncomfortable and bloated. And, you know, it didn't serve a purpose. But I don't think we ever take a step back and perhaps credit that with that's the way we're feeling, because it's just something, again, that we are kind of told to do and we're looking for help. And it's possibly not the right way to, as you say, fuel the body and build lean muscle mass.
I was listening to a new podcast that had Alan Argon on. And so he's the big strength and conditioning guy. And he finally came out and said, fasting is just dumb. Like if you want autophagy, exercise, like eat normally, eat to support lean mass growth. And if you, again, exercise is a stronger stress for autophagy. And I was like, finally, there's another voice out there that's saying the same thing. And it's hitting men and women at the same time. So I'm like, yes, we're not alone in this.
We just need to keep going and banging that drum. And actually, do you know what? It's almost like you've read my mind and you've led me on nicely to, obviously, there are loads of supplements out there. We know there are loads of supplements. I am not necessarily one. I think we'll probably agree on this. You know, your food should be your first source of nutrition. You can get what you need from that. I totally get that, obviously, coming into this life stage, you know, added vitamin D can be important, especially if you live in the UK.
Where it's New Zealand too. Yeah. I'm like, where's the sun?
But creatine. Now, let's talk briefly creatine, because this, you know, little amino acid, this protein has really come to the forefront and we're hearing so much about it now at the moment. In fact, I have mine here in my water.
Yay!
It doesn't taste particularly, well, you can't taste it. It's just a bit grainy.
Yeah.
But creatine, let's go there for just a couple of minutes.
Yeah. So creatine is essential for all the fast energetics of the body. So we're talking about gut health, heart, brain, as well as muscle performance, especially that fast twitch stuff. But as we start looking at creatine for overall health, we see it's so beneficial because our bodies go through different ranges of energy use every day. I think the first time I brought it up on social media was when I was talking to Annie Torsdottir when she was pregnant with her first baby. So she's one of the winners of the CrossFit Games many times over. And she was wanting to know if it was safe to take creatine while she was pregnant. And I was like, absolutely. If it's CreaPure, absolutely. It's totally tested safe. And it's one of the supplements that you should be using when you're pregnant because your body goes through so much. So then I started getting more and more questions about creatine. And it's not the idea of taking 5 grams 4 times a day with carbohydrate and getting all water bloated for that muscle performance, which is the bodybuilding idea. It's your body, your liver specifically, produces around 3 grams a day. But in our life right now, it's not enough to support all the things that our body is going through. And as we get older, we tend to lose our creatine stores. And we see that creatine is really important for mood and mood health. So it attenuates depression. We see it reduces anxiety. And of course, it feeds forward to better muscle performance. So for overall health, creatine is one of the most studied supplements out there. And it's something I feel like everyone should be taking. And there's actually a new website out there called Creatine for Health that is the list of all the health-oriented creatine studies, because people are asking about it and afraid to take it. So they're doing a plethora of studies on women's health and posting those completed randomized control trials and stuff on this website. So people can go in and say, I'm not an athlete, but I'm interested in this. What does it do for me? So that's a big blurb to say every woman should be taking creatine.
Yeah, no, I've been taking it, and I have to say I have found that it's really helped with like recovery and sort of brain clarity. It's definitely been one of the two things that I can definitely hold my hands up. And actually, you know, in terms of building muscle, I'm working at that every day. It's a continuous project. It's not going to come to an end. And I can, you know, I have muscle definition, and I'm whether it's that or not, I have no idea. There is one thing with the creatine, and again, you may not be able to answer. I do or have seen studies where it may not be suitable for patients who have had cancer. I think there's still some research there to be done, just to clarify that potentially for anyone who is listening who has had cancer.
Yeah, it's equivocal, because there's some studies that say that it accelerates tumor growth or tumor regrowth, and then there are other studies that haven't found anything. So just err on the caution of not taking it, or eating a little bit more like chicken and whole foods that have creatine in it. Any animal tissue has creatine in it. But from a supplement standpoint, just be wary that research is still being done.
Yeah. And it's difficult, isn't it? Because obviously the supplementation market is a multi-billion market, and we are sold so many things. But as I said, like, yeah, vitamin D, creatine, and, you know, magnesium, if my sleep's gone a bit wacky, you know, I can find to be really, really helpful. I'm going to come to kind of like my end question. I could talk to you all day and listen to you all day. That's the wonderful thing, and learn so much from you. But what is the one thing you wish every woman knew kind of before? Yeah, I guess plus 35, before coming into perimenopause, that could really stand her in like good stead for the next few years of transition?
Well, first, every woman will go through it, meaning, well, I should quantify that in today's political arena. Every female assigned at birth who has organs for menstruation will go through it, but don't be afraid of it, because it is just a natural point of aging. And understanding that what your body went through at puberty, it's kind of going in the reverse when we hit perimenopause. So you're having changes of your ratios of estrogen and progesterone, but being aware that it will happen and then doing resistance training is super, super helpful on the right step into the transition. There's so many women that I want to just grab and say, stop running hill reps, just get in the gym and do some leg press. Like, it's going to be so helpful later. And this comes from, I'm a long-term endurance athlete. I mean, I ran 20 marathons before I was 20. I was on the crew team. I've raced road bikes. I've done Xterra. I've done Ironman, but I've had strength training through it all. And now that's my primary go-to for exercise, some sprints and some strength training. And it's just amazing to see the research coming out on it. And the earlier you can start it, the better it is for your body.
I love that. Thank you. And also, I do want to say before we go, we have not even touched on HRT, which I love. And I know we spoke about this before we came on. Like, I'm not against HRT. I take HRT. But I think both of us agree that women really need to have a toolkit. And in that toolkit is eating well and lifting weights. HRT is not going to build lean muscle mass. It's not going to, you know, build strong bone. Yes, there is evidence to suggest that obviously replacing estrogen can help with the breakdown of bone, but you need to be eating well and you need to be lifting weights. And I'm happy that two fitness professionals have not, and a doctor have not mentioned HRT in this sort of, you know, holistic conversation.
Yes. So I always say it is a tool in a toolbox, just like you, and you have to do the lifestyle modifications, because when we look at the actual synthetic hormones that are in all the menopause hormone therapies, they're just a little bit of a molecular difference. So it won't actually reverse what's happening. And the other critical thing that people have to remember is, as your body is going through these changes of hormones, you're having small cellular changes of a reduction in certain receptors and receptor expression. So it doesn't mean that the menopause hormone therapy is going to reverse that. So it is something you have to do the work, even if you're taking it. And it's really to get you through this. It's not to replace everything to make you like you were when you were 30.
Thank you. Stacey, I'm sure everybody knows where to find you, but just in case they don't, where can they find you? What's the best place?
For like daily updates and little hints, social media, of course, Instagram. And if you're still on Facebook, we're Dr. Stacey Sims on both of them. And then our website, drstaceysims.com, has an update of all the stuff that we're doing. Our courses, our collab programs that we have with Katrin and Annie, and then also with Haley Happens Fitness for strength training, of course. List of all the books, all that kind of stuff. So yeah, those are the main places you can find me.
Brilliant. Thank you so, so much. And one day I hope to get to meet you in real life. Try and get myself over to New Zealand. Thank you.
Yes, thanks so much.
You can learn more about owning your menopause by going to the website, owningyourmenopause.com, or following Kate on Instagram at katerh_fitness. If you have enjoyed the podcast, please subscribe so you don't miss the next episode. Tell your friends and family and give it a great review so we can help support more women to gain access to information that will help them thrive through menopause. Thank you to our sponsor, Ancient and Brave. As a leading wellness B Corp and a member of 1% for the Planet, sustainability is at the heart of everything they do. This means donating 1% of all sales to environmental causes that protect the planet. By incorporating Ancient and Brave into your daily wellness rituals, you're supporting your whole body health without costing the earth. Use code OYM20 for 20% off your first order. Visit 1percentfortheplanet.org to learn more.